After that, she sat on her weather-beaten porch through many afternoons, gazing down across the fields that undulated in a slow descent to the white and green town. She was wondering what she would do with her life. She was 36, handsome, strong, and free. The years had eaten up Jeffrey's insurance. She had reluctantly parted with the acres to right and left of her, and had even placed a small mortgage on the house. With her husband's death had come a great physical restlessness. She missed having to care for him in the morning. She missed her rush to town, and the brief and therefore accentuated neighbourly meetings in the butchers and grocers. She missed the cooking for two, the preparation of delicate liquid food for him. One day, consumed with energy, she went out and spaded up the whole garden, a thing that had not been done for years. And she was alone at night in the room that had seen the glory of her marriage, and then the pain. To meet Jeff again, she went back in spirit to that wonderful year, that intense, passionate absorption and companionship, rather than looked forward to a problematical meeting hereafter. She awoke often to lie and wish for that presence beside her, inanimate yet breathing, still Jeff. One afternoon, 6 months after his death, she was sitting on the porch in a black dress, which took away the faintest suggestion of plumpness from her figure. It was Indian summer, golden brown all about her, a hush broken by the sighing of leaves. Westward, a 4 o'clock sun, dripping streaks of red and yellow over a flaming sky. Most of the birds had gone. Only a sparrow that had built itself a nest on the cornice of a pillar kept up an intermittent cheeping, varied by occasional fluttering sallies overhead. Roxanne moved her chair to where she could watch him, and her mind idled drowsily on the bosom of the afternoon. Harry Cromwell was coming out from Chicago to dinner. Since his divorce over 8 years before, he had been a frequent visitor. They had kept up what amounted to a tradition between them. When he arrived, they would go to look at Jeff. Harry would sit down on the edge of the bed and in a hearty voice ask, "Well, Jeff, old man, how do you feel today?" Roxanne, standing beside, would look intently at Jeff, dreaming that some shadowy recognition of this former friend had passed across that broken mind. But the head, pale, carven, would only move slowly in its sole gesture toward the light, as if something behind the blind eyes were groping for another light long since gone out. These visits stretched over 8 years, at Easter, Christmas, Thanksgiving, and on many a Sunday, Harry had arrived, paid his call on Jeff, and then talked for a long while with Roxanne on the porch. He was devoted to her. He made no pretense of hiding, no attempt to deepen this relation. She was his best friend, as the mass of flesh on the bed there had been his best friend. She was peace. She was rest. She was the past. Of his own tragedy, she alone knew. He had been at the funeral, but since then, the company for which he worked had shifted him to the east, and only a business trip had brought him to the vicinity of Chicago. Roxanne had written him to come when he could. After a night in the city, he had caught a train out. They shook hands, and he helped her move two rockers together. "How's George?" "He's fine, Roxanne. Seems to like school." "Of course. It was the only thing to do to send him." "Of course. You miss him horribly, Harry." "Yes, I do miss him. He's a funny boy." "He talked a lot about George." Roxanne was interested. Harry must bring him out on his next vacation. She'd only seen him once in her life, a child in dirty rompers. She left him with the newspaper while she prepared dinner. She had 4 chops tonight and some late vegetables from her own garden. She put it all on and then called him, and sitting down together they continued their talk about George. "If I had a child," she would say. Afterward, Harry having given her what slender advice he could about investments, they walked through the garden, pausing here and there to recognise what had once been a cement bench, or where the tennis court had lain. "Do you remember?" Then they were off on a flood of reminiscences. The day they'd taken all the snapshots, and Jeff had been photographed astride the calf. And the sketch Harry had made of Jeff and Roxanne, lying sprawled in the grass, their heads almost touching. There was to have been a covered lattice connecting the barn studio with the house, so that Jeff could get there on wet days. The lattice had been started, but nothing remained except a broken triangular piece that still adhered to the house and resembled a battered chicken coop. And those mint juleps! And Jeff's notebook! Do you remember how we'd laugh, Harry, when he'd get it out of his pocket and read aloud a page of material, and how frantic he used to get? Wild! He was such a kid about his writing. They were both silent a moment, and then Harry said, "We were to have a place out here too. Do you remember? We were to buy the adjoining 20 acres, and the parties we were going to have." Again there was a pause, broken this time by a low question from Roxanne. "Do you ever hear of her, Harry?" "Why, yes," he admitted placidly. "She's in Seattle. She's married again to a man named Horton, a sort of lumber king. He's a great deal older than she is, I believe."
"And she's behaving?"
"Yes. That is, I've heard so. She has everything, you see. Nothing much to do except dress up for this fellow at dinner time."
"I see."
Without effort, he changed the subject. "Are you going to keep the house?"
"I think so," she said, nodding. "I've lived here so long, Harry, it had seemed terrible to move. I thought of trained nursing, but of course that'd mean leaving. I've about decided to be a boarding house lady."
"Live in one?"
"No, keep one. Is there such an anomaly as a boarding house lady? Anyway, I'd have a negress and keep about 8 people in the summer and 2 or 3 if I can get them in the winter. Of course, I'll have to have the house repainted and gone over inside."
Harry considered.
"Roxanne, why, naturally you know best what you can do. But it does seem a shock, Roxanne. You came here as a bride."
"Perhaps," she said, "that's why I don't mind remaining here as a boarding house lady."
"I remember a certain batch of biscuits."
"Oh, those biscuits," she cried. "Still, from all I heard about the way you devoured them, they couldn't have been so bad." "I was so low that day, yet somehow I laughed when the nurse told me about those biscuits."
"I noticed that the 12 nail holes are still in the library wall where Jeff drove them."
"Yes."
It was getting very dark now. A crispness settled in the air. A little gust of wind sent down a last spray of leaves. Roxanne shivered slightly.
"We'd better go in."
He looked at his watch. "It's late. I've got to be leaving. I go east tomorrow."
"Must you?"
They lingered for a moment just below the stoop, watching a moon that seemed full of snow float out of the distance where the lake lay. Summer was gone, and now Indian summer. Grass was cold, and there was no mist and no dew. After he left, she would go in and light the gas and close the shutters, and he would go down the path and on to the village. To these two, life had come quickly and gone, leaving not bitterness, but pity, not disillusion, but only pain. There was already enough moonlight when they shook hands, for each to see the gathered kindness in the other's eyes. Read by Cora MacDonald for Ardis Books, July 2005.